初写真 celebrating the Buddha's great awakening continues. On day three of Sesshin, Kobun Chino Roshi once said, "When I returned to the Zendo today, I felt a very wonderful sensation. When I stepped into the Zendo, you were sitting so deep. It was the sitting before dinner. I think you know what I saw, the feeling of a person who is approaching the peak of a mountain with great confidence, step by step. At the same time, one is very exhausted and doesn't know what it feels like to be on top of the mountain. Approaching the mountain step by step. The third day of sitting usually feels like that. It's hard, but the inner battle of mind adjusting your physical condition to sitting is almost ending. You feel like you're becoming a bird or something after sitting such long 3 days, but you don't need to worry about the coming days. They go very fast, and it becomes rather easy to sit. This is a natural process, and especially for people who are sitting this session for the first time, I'd like to encourage you not to quit. I always feel this kind of sitting practice is like the root of a tree or foundation of a building, very invisible. It's supposed to be invisible. Nothing very splendid happens. Even if I begin with, something has to happen because I have to change my messy life situation. This is the last chance. But against my expectation, what it is tremendous pain. And yet, on the third day, Koblen says, it sometimes gets easier. So some of us are arriving today for Sesshin, and maybe that first ascending the mountain steps, we get out of breath easily, and some of us are continuing into the third day. I don't think there's any set formula for how this works, really. A set formula for each day of how Sesshin is. In this voyage in the middle of the ocean, some days the winds are howling, and sometimes the sea is still as glass. And Sesshin is a time to discover anew, clarify and actualize our deepest intention. I think also quite naturally happens without our trying to clarify. What is our intention again? We sit long enough, it comes into focus quite naturally. Just our own experience of Sesshin life reveals so much about how things work, especially how suffering works and doesn't work. So we talk about attaining great enlightenment, realizing perfect awakening. And that's okay. I think, to say such things, but without stopping to remember what that means, it's easy to then turn that into some vague idea of something good that we don't have now and we want to get. So instead, I've been contemplating the Buddha's great awakening as more like losing something than getting something, about dropping away self-centeredness, self-concern, small self, grasping. Seems like that's the main gist. More could be said, but we could even say that great compassion and love naturally flows forth from just releasing our narrow self-concern. What about me? So, rather than getting anything, more like we have this self-concern, we were born with it. So now we have this chance to deeply study it and let it unravel. If there really were a solid fixed self to be concerned about, then it might be impossible to do this work, but we have heard that it may be just a very convincing illusion, very deep-seated ancient habit, so much so that it's almost impossible to even open to the possibility that it might not be what it seems, that I might not be who I think I am. And so with this aspiration to drop off self-concern for the benefit of all beings, because we see over and over this is the problem for all beings, is my self-concern and their self-concern. So we vow with all beings to hear this true Dharma and then let go of the maybe just really the one basic worldly affair of I am the center of the universe. And then all the other worldly affairs fall away. So when the Bodhisattva has such an aspiration, then she applies the aspiration to these, her practice. The practice becomes boundless giving, harmlessness, patience, diligence, presence, openness. Yesterday we talked about giving, the Bodhisattva's giving, in terms of these practices coming forth from the dropped off small self. We'd say this, the usually held small self is basically holding back. And so the practice of giving is to like not hold back, to let everything, our life, flow forth as an offering to all beings, is giving. It means releasing, holding back from this small self-centered one. And then the second paramita of Shila, I've been translating this week. I think there's no fixed translations with these, but I'm appreciating the translating Shila as harmlessness. Often it's translated as morality or ethics, ethical conduct, discipline. I think morality and ethics sound a little too dry, maybe, or like you should be doing this. Too rule-based, maybe. Even precepts. Sometimes it's translated as precepts. So precepts, ethics, and morality. I have valid translations, but sometimes they don't taste quite right. Sometimes I like to think of Shila as a virtue. It's a positive term. But maybe that's too vague. So this week I kind of feel like harmlessness. But that's also not totally complete, because there's a positive side of Shila, not just the restraint of from harm or not harming, but I think the heart of Shila Paramita is harmlessness. And so if Dana Paramita, or giving, is the is releasing the self, the illusory self that holds back from giving, a stingy self, we could say that this Shila Paramita, or harmlessness, is almost like the opposite. It's the small self-concerned self. Instead of holding back, sometimes the small self goes out and tries messing around with the world and causes all kinds of trouble. To get things for itself, it harms others. I harm others. So instead of releasing the held back self, in this case it's more like restraining the small self that's going out and harming others. So they're almost like two sides of a coin, I think, Dana and Shila. In English, Dana and Shila are two names, right? Dana and Shila work together. One's releasing the holding back small self, and one's kind of like gathering back in the like going out self, trying to get something self. But they're both same thing in terms of letting go of self concern. Of course, we know this means we take care of this body and mind in an appropriate way, but we often add a lot of more to that than we need to. Buddha recommended taking care of this body and mind carefully, taking care of our health and life, and yet that protective, fearful, small me in there causes so much trouble, in addition to just taking care of our life. So Vasubandhu's treatise on the Awakening Bodhicitta Sutra, the Hotsu Bodai Shin Sutra treatise, it brings up, based on this bodhicitta, this aspiration, bodhisattva's practice, Shila. There's all of these have these, you know, three aspects. And does anyone know the three types of sila, or harmlessness, or virtue. Sometimes it's said, like in the Sandinirmochana Sutra and other sutras, Mahayana sutras, it said sila is embracing and sustaining standards of conduct, right conduct, embracing and sustaining all good, and embracing and sustaining living beings. That's one threefold sila from the old sutras that we still recite today. And but in this treatise of Vasubandhu, he says the threefold, three types of harmlessness is those precepts or practices related to the body, related to speech, and related to mind. Right? So, body, speech, and mind practices, and then he enumerates them as these 10 virtuous actions of bodhisattvas. So the body practices are, you know, basically these are our bodhisattva precepts. Not killing, not taking what's not given, not misusing sexuality are harmlessness with the body. And the speech practices are not speaking falsely, not speaking of others' faults, not praising self and belittling others, and not idly, uselessly, randomly chattering about meaningless garbage. This is the hardest one, of course. And I'm not, and maybe I would say the least harmful. Sometimes we just have some fun, meaningless chatter. But I guess when the Buddha is feeling really like, let's use every moment in the best way, let's not use our verbal energy to meaninglessly talk about, you know, distract ourselves. So of course in Sesshin, we really get into this one in particular just because we're basically silent. Makes it pretty easy. And then the three mind, so there's the four speech, three body, and the three mind, harmless conducts are not being possessive, not being angry, not holding false views. In our precepts, we say not disparaging the three treasures. They're quite similar. And in our precepts, then we have this not intoxicating self or others. So if you had to match up these lists, you could say that one is a replacement of no idle chatter. You could say maybe intoxicants is like just kind of like useless. You can get into useless, meaningless dribble with no, you know, not necessarily so harmful to others, but maybe not so useful. So a lot of these practices, these 10 virtues, are naturally, we just fall into place in Sesshin life. Because it's so simple, our life's so simple, it's easier than ever to practice harmlessness in this kind of container. And but it's also a chance to look at our larger life outside of Sesshin, and particularly on. These days, looking at Sila Paramita with harmlessness in relation to the larger environmental issues on this planet. maybe most related to not killing life. And I think that first precept comes first on the Buddha's list because it's so basic. And it includes killing also sometimes is expanded to include just not harming living beings. So of course we know about and are aware of these other precepts, like the speech precepts. But I thought focusing on Shila Paramita today, just to talk a little bit more about this environmental disaster called our world. There's a couple new books, partly why I'm thinking about it, that I've been looking at. I have for the library here. One's called How Much is Enough? Buddhism, Consumerism, and the Human Environment. A collection of essays by different people. And some quite moving things. And another is A Buddhist Response to the Climate Emergency. Also many essays by different Dharma teachers and scientists. This theme seems to be emerging in the Dharma world in the last few years, and I think will emerge more and more in the future years. We can't deny that there's major impacts that humans are having on this world and the living beings of this world. And I think that I think we can, you know, often for me it comes down to not being a politician myself and not being a scientist and feeling like sometimes a little bit hopeless in the face of the vastness of these issues, that I feel like really coming from the Buddha and the generations of ancestors, just taking care of our life, how we take care of our life, I think is really the most tangible way to address this, or one of them. Like, I can't even think of how many online petitions I've signed to try to stop the Keystone pipeline. I mean, so many, from so many different groups, and it seems to keep going back and forth, this kind of thing, and I think that's great, and I think these petitions do make differences. I know sometimes they make major ones, and I do appreciate doing some of those. I can't respond to all of them that come to my mailbox, because once you start signing them, you just get more and more. So I pick and choose a little bit. I'm pretty sure that Satya spends like several hours a day, I think I said once, just signing online petitions and sending them out to his friends. It's hard to know how effective, but I think that it's worth doing. And the nice thing about that is it's very easy. It takes like one moment. And it doesn't use up any like paper even or anything. It's part of the new technology, that one way to respond, a little way. But you know, when I think of all those petitions trying to stop this mega thing, and then at the same time I think, well, what's really driving it, that project, right? And it's complex, right? Because there's big industries with huge financial investments in these things. But the bottom line underneath all that is like, we're using oil. I mean, if we weren't using oil, it wouldn't be an issue. So I think it's good to the political actions, the petitions, the exactly how, you know, how we're going to get our oil matters. And but this underlying thing is going to the root, I think, you know, our practice is trying to always go back to the root of things. And it's our need that's creating these issues. And a friend of mine, a Zen teacher up in Portland, who has a very nice Dharma blog that she's mostly dealing with issues about, like, kind of larger world issues. So we, just a few days before Sishin, she posted something about, I think the title of this blog post was like, does our lifestyle choices as practitioners really make a difference to this climate emergency? And then this, I didn't get a chance to read the whole thing, but basically there's these programs that maybe you know about where you can plug in your lifestyle, your numbers of how much you use for things, and it will show you how many worlds are necessary to support. If everybody in the world had your lifestyle, how many planets would be necessary to sustain that lifestyle? Has anyone done this? You know about that? What's it called? Do you know the website? Oh, we could figure it out. Find out later. Ecological footprint. There might even be more than one, but that was she did this, and she's like, I'm an aware, conscious, practicing Zen practitioner. I really want to look at these things. I try to like have a low impact life, and I plugged in, you know, relatively as a 21st century American. I plugged in my numbers, and I think at the top of her blog, it was like the picture of 3.5 Earths would be necessary to sustain her lifestyle if everybody had her conscious lifestyle. That's what made her write this. Is this really enough? Is our conscious simplicity enough to solve this problem? And then she got into some details about it, I think, but I felt uneasy myself reading it. I think, and she addressed, well, it's these bigger, you know, institutional things are in place, bigger political forces, huge industries, lobbying, trying, and big money involved. And yet, the reason I felt uncomfortable is, again, because all of these things are only there because people use them and pay for them. And I think it is our lifestyle, is the bottom line, whatever. There's better and worse ways to go about things, of course. But I guess from a practitioner's point of view, I think, what can I do to even rely less on these forces that are causing this harm? And it's hard. I think part of it is like our, and this part of Dharma too here, is our view that like our simple Dharma lifestyle in America is actually like, compared to the rest of the world, is not so simple, actually. So this in How Much Is Enough here, Stephanie Kaza, who I think is a Green Gulch resident. Do you know her?
Well, she's still here. She
Wow. All the more appropriate. She used to live right here at Santa Cruz Zen Center. Yeah, Kobe.
Not at the center.
Oh, yeah. Santa Cruz, though.
Yeah.
Ah. Yeah, and to Liz, do you know her, too?
Through Wendy. So she's teaching at University of Vermont, but I heard that she just moved to Portland a couple weeks ago.
Oh, really? Yeah. Huh. Well, I think she lived at Green Gulch Farm for a while, maybe in the 70s or something, too. How Much Is Enough? Buddhist Perspectives on Consumerism. She has a nice essay here where she's got this, I haven't read all of this either, but she's got this little chart here that has these three categories called, the chart is consumption and consumer classes. And so one category is called poor. So I guess there's about 5 or 6 billion people on the planet. Yeah. So 1.1 billion out of that number is in this poor category. And so the first column here is diet, insufficient grain, unsafe water. This is the mega poor, very poor. Transportation, walking. Materials that they use for their life, local biomass. Maybe means like their fuel is dried cow dung. You see this a lot in India. Lodging, huts and shanties. Income per year below $700. And percent of world income, 2%. So 2%, but this is 1.1 billion out of 5 or 6 billion. Then the next middle column is the largest number, 3.3 billion people. So over half of the world's population is, it says here. Oh yeah, over half the world's population, but it's 33% of the world's income. And this is $700 to $7,500 per year income. And there's transport here. These are really general categories, but transportation for these masses is bicycles and buses. Materials is durables and reusing building materials and so on. Lodging includes some electricity. And then so there's the poor, the middle, and then there's the category called consumers. That's us. This is 1.1 billion, same as the poor. So this middle range, which we would consider quite poor, but not the most poor. Middle range is the most. But the consumers is above $7,500 a year, which is not that much, right? That's below the poverty. What's the poverty line in America? It's half the poverty line, but this is still considered the wealthiest consumers. 64% of the world income, and the diet for the middle group was grain and clean water, as opposed to insufficient grain and unsafe water. But for the consumers, the majority diet is meat, packaged food, and soft drinks. Of course, not the whole story, but it's a big part of our culture, yeah? Even for the poor in our culture. Yeah, yeah. I bet soft drinks... I bet more soft drinks are sold than fruit juice. Yeah, to our country in general. I mean, I don't know, but it's cheap and there's nothing in it, right? And it's highly packaged. Transportation, private cars, materials, throwaways, lodging, climate-controlled, electrified buildings. So this is like just kind of the norm for even the poor, right, in our country. And just puts things into a different perspective. Americans comprise only 4.7% of the Earth's people, yet they produce 25% of greenhouse gas emissions. And this global consumer class that includes even below the poverty line in America is responsible for 90% of the chlorofluorocarbons destroying the ozone layer and 96% of the world's radioactive waste. So, you know, it goes on and on. We've probably heard a lot of the numbers. The very scary numbers. When I hear them again each time, it's unbelievable. But there's some nice Dharma stuff here that she ties in this essay. So these are Buddhist critiques of consumerism. Three primary critiques, she suggests, coming from Buddha Dharma understanding. First, consumerism can be seen as a central force in the process of identity formation or production. As one Buddhist activist points out, consumerism as it has developed has given corporations, governments, and other powers a tool which takes advantage of our dispositions to concoct me and mine. So I think this is like the advertising industry, right? And you will be a happy little self if you have this item. And, you know, we maybe don't fall for advertising so much. I always am amazed that, like, that advertising really works. But I think, you know, billions of dollars go into this, right? It's like, I think it works. It has an effect on many people, conscious or unconsciously. Material accumulation strongly reinforces the view that things are separate, fixed, and permanent. The more we relate to material objects as real and permanent, the more deeply we tend to think of ourselves as a fixed object or self with specific identity. Kind of interesting, this no self teaching being tied into like how consumerism kind of feeds the view. I think I can see how I could feel that in myself some. This confusion prevents us from experiencing the world as interdependent, co-creating, and in dynamic flux. Attachment to a false view of self as object can lead to more and more need for self-reinforcing possessions. The view, then that's the view of kind of the extreme of true existence of things and a self. And then the other extreme view, right, is the attachment to a false view. The view that things lack any reality at all can itself be used as a rationalization for consumerism. Since nothing is real, nothing really matters, so why not indulge in whatever offers some momentary pleasure? This confusion prevents us from fully engaging the actual relationships of the world that shape and condition our lives. Attachment to insubstantiality can lead to false reasoning and undervaluing of the relations behind what is consumed. That's a beautiful description of the middle way as a practice and realization to undermine consumerism. And how both I really exist and those things really exist is a problem, and things don't exist at all and it doesn't matter is also a problem. But the middle way of interdependent relationships and things coming to be and having effects, cause and effect, is playing out in this world with everything we do and consume. And this is like, this middle way seems like the more we attune to the middle way, the more we see our place in this web of the modern world of consumerism. The second critique, the Buddhist critique of consumerism, promotes, rationalizes, and condones harming. Consumer products of all kinds depend on loss of animal and plant life, unpleasant or even debilitating factory conditions, increased climate impact from trade and transportation, and harmful behavior between people. Slavery in the name of product manufacturing is not uncommon even today in a lot of these third world countries. Tremendous harm to many forms of life is justified for the sake of profit and gain. Buddhist ethics would series, or Shila Paramita, would seriously question such a justification. The foundational principle behind all Buddhist ethics or sila is non-harming or ahimsa, harmlessness. This is expressed as the first of the precepts, not killing or doing no harm. Following this precept as a guiding principle would mean investigating the origins of all consumer products and doing the best one could to choose those for which no harm has been committed. No harm may be impossible, but minimizing. And then the third Buddhist critique of consumerism is that consumerism promotes desire and dissatisfaction, the very source of suffering, as described in the Second Noble Truth. Like, but not really be satisfied unless we have such and such. Yeah. She even goes so far as to say, craving also includes the desire for non-being. We chant in the sutra, we say craving for sense pleasures, craving for being, and craving for non-being, which in this case, one craves relief or escape from what is unpleasant or desirable. A headache, for example, or a wilting heat wave. So you could say, craving for the non-being of this totally unpleasant hot room. For the non-being of this hot room, I will turn on the air conditioner. So, I think I think her essay, she says later, she talks about, you know, there's our individual practices, but then there's also institutional practices as like Zen centers. So I think here we are in a spiritual institution which only exists to free beings from suffering. We could say, we might forget that, but it's one way to look at the purpose of a Zen center is to free beings from suffering. So in our freeing beings from suffering by offering Zazen and so on, are we causing suffering to others? It's hard to look at these things, and we're trying. We're Interfaith Power and Light is an organization that's looking into religious institutions to try to particularly environmental impact. So we're Zen Center is committing to trying to look at how we take care of the physical grounds and property and our impact on things. So she says, we'd like to offer a few suggestions for launching a Buddhism consumer activism movement. First, Buddhist centers could make it a priority to model the reduction of consumption, promoting a lifestyle based on simplicity and restraint. In California, Green Gulch Zen Center and Spirit Rock Meditation Center already have strong commitments to vegetarianism, waste recycling, and land stewardship. As visitors come to these centers for teaching, they pick up the culture of the place. And I think that's one way you could say it's just us taking care of the thing, but we're creating culture too. Maybe less than a place like Green Gulch where thousands of people are coming through, but people are looking to how to live in this world, right? Interpretive booklets and signs could be added to make practices more obvious. Buddhist centers could take up policy change by developing green operations principles and mission statements. Very few centers have taken these first steps of codifying their consumer practices as an institution. And people could get together and do this. So, I It's a big topic, I think. But what can we do? And in a way, you could say, Sesshin. We're in the middle of a Sesshin, right? I think Sesshin is creating like a very low impact lifestyle for the week. I think we do pretty good. I think it's maybe we should have more Sesshins as an environmental response. Right? we share food helps when the Tenzos are trying to use my huge collection of plastic bags in shopping. You know, little things all add up to big things. So plastic is just something that doesn't disappear in this world, and it's a petroleum product, right? So so many things come packaged, but it's nice when you have a bigger group. Even alone, you can buy things in bulk, but in Sesshin is very natural to buy things in bulk. And I think we should never need to use another plastic bag. And if anybody needs any for their home, we have an overstock here. You can take them home. And sometimes when I, you know, where we draw the line is hard, because we don't want to, we can be, again, there's a middle way. We can become obsessive, and then we can become kind of lazy. You know, I think these are the two extremes around these things. And where that line is hard to say. Like sometimes I'm downtown, and I'm like, oh, here I'm at the food store, and I need something. I didn't think of it beforehand, but let me go in and get it. And then I think, but I don't have a plastic bag. And so usually I'll say, like, then I'm not going to get this bulk item until I come back later with a plastic bag. It's inconvenient, but I'm not going to take another one of those bags. And occasionally I have, you know, and it's hard to say what's the, which is what's falling into obsessiveness and what's falling into like, oh, it's just a little thing. It's just, I just don't want to come back later. It's okay this time. Is that laziness? Or is it? I think each one of us has to find the place. And for a while now we've been doing vegan sesshins. And I feel really great about that. I think it's kind of standard in a lot of Zen centers to at least do vegetarian, but I just want to say that I hope there's not the feeling that this is just indulging Kokyo's personal like food trip, because it could look that way. Kokyo and Patrick's vegan thing, because for me it's really, this vegan thing is not about, because I like that food more, it's preference, and it's actually not about health either, although many people would say it's healthier. I think you get into big debates about the health thing here. So I, in a discussion about Sila, I wouldn't even go there. And some people say that it's not healthy. I at least without eggs and dairy, I feel not well. I feel weak and unhealthy. Many people say this, and including the Dalai Lama and his doctors. So we can't, you know, I wouldn't want to argue with people's experience. I think if sometimes somebody, I had a very long Facebook debate with somebody about this, and they said they lived at San Francisco Zen Center, which is, you know, lacto-ovo-vegetarian for like half a year, and they said they came out really sick, the sickest they've been in their life, and as soon as they had meat again, they felt, they like totally rejuvenated energy. And I think part of the thing too is, if you know, at least to be vegan, you do have to be careful. It's not just like eat whatever. And you know, I think if we were doing this sesshin for longer, maybe we'd really look at the menus carefully, because you do need calcium, iron, B12, zinc, omega-3 fatty acids. There's things that you don't naturally get without paying attention to a plant-based diet. So I think people just, just eliminate this and then I feel unhealthy. But it takes a little research and work. I think just, kill the animals in general is a huge step. I think that's a major thing. One time my teacher, Tenshin Roshi, said in a public Sunday talk at Green Gulch about the environment, and this was 15 years ago or something, but I think it's the same. He said, I think really the two things that are really like our major lifestyle in this country that have a huge impact on the environment is meat eating and fossil fuels, particularly in transportation, also heating. These things are huge, and if we just go a little bit in that direction, I think it makes a difference. And then to add in the dairy and eggs part is same principle, but I think it's less extreme. Some people might say more, because the principle is basically that the cows, the dairy cows, as soon as they, aside from factory farming, just as soon as a dairy cow is not productive anymore, which they're still maybe quite young, you can't just keep them alive for pets, right? You can't afford to do that, so they have to be killed. As soon as they stop producing products for the humans, they're useless, and they're killed. And then same with the laying hens. As soon as they stop producing, they're killed. But maybe even more extreme, ironically, is the males in these female-based industries. Dairy and eggs are relying on the females, but the males that are born, because they have to keep breeding them, 50% are males, and they're immediately useless because they're different breeds than meat cows. So they become the baby veal, and they're horrible conditions and are killed very young. And same with the male chicks. Sometimes we see pictures of some of the industries just throw the little live chickens into big giant plastic garbage bags while they're still alive. They're just useless stuff, right? These are sentient beings with inconceivably wondrous Buddha nature is their like mind stream. It's so painful to me to think about how we treat sentient beings in this world. But I think we make this effort, right? So here we have a 7-day vegan sashimi and buying bulk food and minimizing our resources, and we're warming the zendo with our body heat on days like this. Living in California helps. And then we create a possible thing. We can find joy in this kind of life. And then it gets complicated. Sashin ends and we go back to our lives. And can we remember the joy of just being alive in this way? We don't really need that much, actually. So that's one aspect of Shila Paramita, harmlessness in this modern day world. Sometimes we don't talk about the precepts exactly like that, but that's how it came out this time around. Any comments or concerns or disturbances? Yes.
I'm just remembering from the All Father meeting, I think a lot of people expressed
Okay. Yes, it's already running late. May our noble intentions to give ourselves to all beings and refrain from harm throughout this session and throughout our lives equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow